This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
China urges the US to return to the Iran nuclear deal, quote, unconditionally and lift all relevant sanctions against Tehran. The World Health Organization says the COVID-19 situation in the United States is, quote, punishing and shocking. Also ahead, Romania's Prime Minister, Ludovic Orban, resigns the day after disappointing results for his Liberal Party in parliamentary elections. Our top story, China calls on all parties to the Iran nuclear deal to push for the unconditional return of the US to the agreement and lift all relevant sanctions against Tehran. Earlier we discussed the matter in detail with the guests in our news review program. Welcome. China has called on all parties to the Iran nuclear deal to consolidate a consensus to preserve the accord and push for the unconditional return of the US to the agreement. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman stressed that the parties must push for the US to resume its compliance to the deal and lift all relevant sanctions. Hua Chunying said upholding the JCPOA should be the precondition of any diplomatic and political solution to the Iranian nuclear issue. Earlier, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said Tehran will not renegotiate the 2015 accord, adding that Washington must return to the deal to fulfill its obligations. U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the agreement in 2018 and reinstated sanctions targeting almost all Iranian sectors. The head of Iran's central bank says Washington's measures have even hindered the country's efforts to purchase the COVID-19 vaccine. Joining us is Professor David Yerubian, and we also have Frank Emsbach, Emeritus Professor at the University of Wisconsin. Gentlemen, welcome. Professor Yerubian, if I can start with you, and what's your take here, China urging Washington to return to the Iran nuclear deal and with no conditions?
I think the foreign ministry spokeswoman's statement was unequivocal. Essentially, the precondition for any dialogue beyond the what has already been established in the JCPOA would be the United States returning fully to the JCPOA and entering into full compliance, which would mean most importantly dropping all of the primary and secondary sanctions. So it is the word unconditional that is really key in her statement that she gave at a really wide-ranging press conference, but she was just unequivocal, and this accords, of course, with the stance of the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, and other statements that have been made from the foreign minister's office regarding the critical importance of American compliance with the deal as a prerequisite for any potential future discussion. There is a United Nations Resolution 2231 that has been repeatedly violated by the United States continuously since May of 2018, and as well the United States has threatened other nations for maintaining their compliance with this United Nations Security Council resolution. So the United States needs to meet its obligations under international law, under the agreement that it signed on to as a precursor to any potential further discussion related to any other issues.
Right. And Frank, I want to get your views on this statement by Beijing that says upholding the Iran nuclear deal should be the precondition of any diplomatic and political solution to the whole entire Iranian nuclear issue.
Well, it's pretty clear what their position is. The cultural problem here, or the political problem here, is that President-elect Biden has made it clear he wants to rejoin the treaty. But there's tremendous pressures in this country when somebody says unconditional, and all of a sudden everybody says, oh, we can't have that. And the United States has been very, very reluctant over any administration to accept that kind of language. I'm not saying that's the right position or the thing that is legally correct or anything, but as a political matter. At the same time, there are pressures within the administration, very strong pressures, to demand other things from Iran, to attach other things to it. President Biden and President-elect Biden has also mentioned issues of development of long-range missiles or medium-range missiles. Maybe that should be part of the discussion. And, of course, you have the Republicans who are going to take this and beat them over the head with it. At the same time, you have a strong right-wing Israeli lobby within the administration, not very public, who are doing everything possible to support Israel as they conduct provocative actions in Iran, probably with the United States government support, although nobody knows that, to sort of box President-elect Biden in, so that he looks like he's going to be conceding something by just going back to the table. And so I think it's going to be a tricky situation, and it's going to be up to those people in Congress and in the United States public to say, let's get back to usual here. At the same time, there is a humanitarian aspect, and I don't think there's any question about that in terms of the overall effects on the Iranian economy, but specifically the fear of financial institutions that somehow they're going to be held responsible or liable by somebody if they begin to transfer money in accordance with their duties.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guests for their analysis. David Yerubian, a professor of history at CSU San Bernardino, and Frank Emspeck, emeritus professor, University of Wisconsin. European Union foreign ministers have adopted a plan aimed at making the 27-nation bloc less dependent on the United States, the United Kingdom, and China. The ministers argue that the chaotic presidency of Donald Trump has highlighted the necessity for such a move. Jerome Hughes has the details.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now, a top World Health Organization official has described the COVID-19 situation in the United States as punishing and shocking.
I mean, the U.S. is accounting for a third of all world cases at the moment over the last number of weeks. The epidemic in the U.S. is punishing. It's widespread. It's quite frankly shocking, you know, to see 1 to 2 persons a minute die in the U.S.
Ryan also encouraged Americans to keep maintaining social distancing, even if it sounds terrible. Meanwhile, the top U.S. infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci said the mid-January will be a, quote, dark time as the holiday season approaches. The comments come as the country saw its deadliest week of the pandemic since April, with 15,000 fatalities. The U.S. is also now averaging 200,000 daily cases. The virus has so far claimed over 283,000 lives out of over 14.9 million confirmed infections. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the Americas, Brazil's death toll has surpassed 177,000, while confirmed cases there top 6.6 million. The U.S. federal watchdog agency says an advisor to President Donald Trump has knowingly and willfully violated federal law by attacking Trump's rival in last month's presidential vote. The agency said in a report that Peter Navarro, a trade advisor to Trump, conducted 6 media interviews lambasting Joe Biden. All the interviews were conducted while Navarro appeared in his official capacity. The advisor said Biden had been bought by China and was compromised. The report cites White House officials' explanations as saying that Navarro's statements on Biden-China relationship were, quote, kind of factual. The agency concludes that it is up to President Donald Trump to determine an appropriate disciplinary action. Elsewhere, Romania's Prime Minister Ludovic Orban has resigned following disappointing results for his Liberal Party in Sunday's parliamentary elections.
I decided to hand in my resignation as Prime Minister today. The negotiations that will follow must lead to a government made of center-right political parties that clearly support Romania's Euro-Atlantic orientation. My goal is to build a parliamentary majority that will not include the Social Democratic Party.
In his televised statement, Orban stressed that for him, national interest comes before the party and personal one. President Klaus Johannes will now pick another cabinet member as interim premier. With almost 95% of votes counted, the ruling National Liberal Party won over 25% compared to 30% for the opposition Social Democrats. The Liberals might still continue to govern as part of a centre-right coalition, as President Johannes has suggested he won't nominate a Prime Minister from the PSD. The European Union and the UK remain divided on key issues as time is running out for the two to clinch a post-Brexit trade deal. Diplomatic sources from both sides said there was no progress in talks on Monday, with some noting that the prospect for an agreement has become even narrower now than before. In a joint statement, EU Chief Ursula von der Leyen and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said a deal is impossible due to disagreements on critical issues. The two leaders added they will have an in-person discussion ahead of the Wednesday deadline for the talks. Differences remain over fisheries, business rules and trade in Northern Ireland after the Brexit transition period expires at the end of this month. Journalist and commentator James Tweedie says from London's perspective, it's pointless to make a deal that would make the EU-UK relationship the same as they were before Brexit.
There's no real point in leaving the EU if we continue to be bound by European Union rules and regulations, which we no longer have any say in making. That's a problem. People often downplay the significance of the fishing industry here, but it's something which is that important to the French, which also have quite a small fishing fleet, to be honest. It's something that's important. That's that important to the French that they are going to potentially scupper the whole deal. What does everybody want? We don't want to stay under regulatory alignment with the EU. That's no. If Britain is going to get any advantage from Brexit, it's because we're going to be able to change something. And if nothing changes, there was no point to it.
Meanwhile, a senior EU diplomat says the European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, is rather downbeat about the prospects of sealing a new trade deal with Britain.
For Brexit supporters and many coastal communities, this deal symbolises regaining sovereignty in an age-old dispute over fishing rights. The UK says British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats, but the EU wants things to stay relatively the same with access for its boats and no tariffs or taxes on goods crossing borders. The EU's bargaining chip is special access to the EU single market, which the UK wants to hold on to as 60% of the fish its boats catch is sold to the bloc. The EU says something's got to give, though, insisting Britain cannot have priority access to its own fisheries and the EU market.
How do we explain to fishermen that they can't go into British waters, but then they import fish to Bologna? That's very complicated, believe me.
Wars have almost been waged over these fishing waters. Britain and Iceland clashed over cod between the 1950s and 1970s, with the Royal Navy deploying 37 warships to protect British interests. The Scallop Wars in 2018 that saw French and British trawlmen come to blows in the English Channel threatened an uneasy truce reached in 2012, when the UK agreed to keep larger boats away from French waters in exchange for additional access rights. Since Britain formally left the EU on January 31st, negotiators have missed a series of deadlines to reach a deal with the world's largest trading bloc before the transition period ends on December 31st. And although the UK hopes these really are the last few days before a deal, it is not ruling out an extension.
I think we probably are now in the final few days in terms of being able to decide whether there can be an agreement. Of course, look, if the ambience warms up again and actually great progress is made and it's just about sorting out the detail, well, then you can always find more time, you can always extend. But I think unless we can resolve these quite fundamental divergences at the moment, then we are going to have to take a position in the next few days.
If a satisfactory deal is not reached, the British economy, which has already been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic, will suffer even more. And it will also mean bilateral trade falling back on World Trade Organization rules for 2021, which is far from Brexit's purported goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Now elsewhere, Russia has hailed Venezuela's legislative elections as transparent after a socialist alliance led by President Nicolas Maduro scored a major win in the vote. In a statement, Russia's foreign ministry added that no serious violations had been recorded during the Sunday's vote. Maduro also said that the election was a great victory that enables the country to recover its national assembly. The current assembly is led by US-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido, who repeatedly failed to win major public support in his bid to oust the government. Guaido had urged opposition blocs to boycott the vote. Election turnout was only 31%, but the electoral authority declared socialist winner of most votes casted. Now, the results have been rejected by the United States and the European Union that have long supported the opposition. brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, a Nobel Prize winning peace activist, Jody Williams, on Friday, December 4th, both joined a grassroots progressive campaign urging Joe Biden not to nominate Michelle Flournoy as his Pentagon chief, warning her ties to the weapons industry, hawkish record, and current positions disqualify her for a powerful role. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Because She Was Wrong About Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya, Daniel Ellsberg Joins Campaign Against Flournoy. Here's the details of this article. Legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg and Nobel Prize-winning peace activist Jody Williams on Friday, December 4th, both joined a grassroots progressive campaign urging Joe Biden not to nominate Michelle Flournoy as his Pentagon chief, warning her ties to the weapons industry, hawkish record, and current positions disqualify her for the powerful role. Flournoy was wrong about Iraq, as Biden has acknowledged he was. But she was then also wrong about Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya, Ellsberg said in a statement released by RootsAction.org, part of a coalition of progressive advocacy groups pressuring the former vice president to pick a defense secretary committed to peace and without ties to the military-industrial complex. She's wrong right now in opposing the congressional ban on all arms sales to Saudi Arabia and in planning to maintain Minuteman-type land-based ICBMs, the hair trigger to the doomsday machine, Ellsberg continued. Her unquestioned intelligence and competence have long been in service to her serious interventionist misjudgments and to her own involvement in a revolving door military-industrial complex, he added. To the chagrin of progressives leading the charge against Flourney, the former Pentagon official has gained the support of some prominent organizations, including the Plowshares Fund and the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Other anti-war groups have yet to speak out publicly about Flourney, who is still considered the Biden team's front runner for defense secretary. If Joe Biden really has a progressive agenda in mind for his administration, he should appoint members of his cabinet and other high-level positions who demonstrate progressive thinking and do not move this fractured country backwards, Williams said on Friday, December 4th. Nominating Michelle Flourney for defense secretary would not be forward thinking. We do not need a hawk with relationships with the weapons industry. During a call earlier this week, attended by representatives of more than 100 anti-war and nuclear disarmament groups, some participants resisted criticizing Flourney, who currently serves on the board of massive defense contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, over her industry ties. Mother Jones reported on Thursday, December 3rd, that Daryl Kimball, executive director of the Arms Control Association, said during the call that criticism of Flourney's ties to the defense industry could just as easily apply to the other nominees Biden is considering, a perhaps unintentionally damning assessment of Biden's other potential Pentagon nominees. According to the Wall Street Journal, other candidates in the running for the post include former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, a Lockheed Martin board member, and Jen Lloyd Austin, a Raytheon board member. Others who took part in the call, such as Code Pink co-founder Media Benjamin, were adamant that Flourney's militaristic record calls for nothing less than forceful opposition from progressives. It feels to me like this is a major, major concession of liberal foreign policy community, Benjamin told Mother Jones. It doesn't bode well for challenging the Biden administration on key foreign policy issues, she added. As The Intercept's Jeremy Schill wrote on Friday, December 4th, Flourney is a notorious hawk who backed the wars in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen and pushed for Obama to intervene in Libya. Flourney began her government career in Bill Clinton's administration, serving at a Pentagon, Schill noted. In 2005, at the height of the Bush-Cheney global war, Flourney joined a gaggle of mostly neocons at the notorious Project for the New American Century and criticizing the Bush administration for not being militaristic enough in its foreign policy and arguing for an increase in ground troops in the Middle East. Matthew Ho, a former State Department official who resigned in protest against the U.S. war in Afghanistan in 2009, said in a statement on Friday, December 4th, that he does not understand how the Democratic Party continues to embrace and promote the people responsible for this nation's unending wars. Flournoy has been integral in the failed, counterproductive, and catastrophic wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, Syria, Libya, and across Saharan and sub-Saharan Africa, said Ho. Flournoy's resume is conclusive evidence she will serve to justify massive Pentagon budgets, weapon sales to despots, and vainglorious wars, while bringing the colossal waste to U.S. taxpayers, death without purpose to American service members, and unending horror to tens of millions of people in the Muslim world.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان العين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salamu alaykum, dear brothers and sisters. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. And welcome to the program of Islamic Upbringing, here on IRIB English Radio. In this program, we discuss the problems and questions that parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawdha Ilmiya Qum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Miqdad.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah to you and to all the listeners out there.
So, Brother Miqdad, the first question is, my child is 6 years old and due to the current situation of COVID, we have to stay indoors. And I'm struggling with her feeling really bored at home. And she seems lethargic all day, constantly asking for snacks. Do you have any suggestions? So, Brother Miqdad, it's actually a common question that many parents are having these days. What do you have to say about it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, indeed we're facing some difficult times, especially with parents. I mean, many parents naturally are struggling with this difficult time where we have to stay indoors, parks are closed, public places are closed, and naturally it's a struggle for parents and completely understandable. Regarding this particular question, I'd like to suggest or highlight rather the importance of exercise and the importance of letting out what child's energy. I think we've mentioned many times previously that children have a lot of energy in them, right? Yeah. And it's important that they have the opportunity to let out that energy, basically. And we've talked about exercise as a very important physical need that children have, and that they have to be going outdoor, running, jumping, climbing trees, doing all sorts of different sports and exercise. This makes their body strong, it brings balance, and we talked about how this physical need has a very strong impact on their emotional aspect, on the emotional growth that they have. They're feeling happy, they're feeling much more enthusiastic, much more cooperative, at home, their behavior is very much impacted by the level of exercise that they do. And ultimately, we also realize that exercise has a very strong impact on the intellectual and spiritual growth of a child, that research has suggested, I think we've mentioned previously as well, how exercise plays a role in one's academic performance, one's understanding, and on the other side, how sedentary behavior and lack of movement, basically, which is in today's world is quite common, not just because of TV and computer games and everything, but now with COVID on top of that, we have to stay at home and you don't have really space to move around or to jump around, etc. This can have a lot of negative social, mental, physical and behavioral issues, basically. So definitely a struggle that we have to overcome, and one of the ways to overcome is through exercise, and a lot of exercise.
So what about in the situation of lockdown?
So exercise can be in different ways, right? I mean, the ideal situation, the ideal scenario will be to have exercise outside, outdoor, on a social level, basically. So different kind of sports, whether it's football, basketball, swimming, talking about going to the park to run around with the ball, depending on the child's age and abilities, obviously, and likes in terms of sports. But now with lockdown and the different restrictions that we have, it's up to parents to be very creative and come up with brand new ideas on how to tackle this issue.
Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad. And dear listeners, stay with us and we'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
So welcome back, dear listeners, to the program of Islamic upbringing. So we're talking to Brother Miqdad about what children can do in the situation of lockdown. So Brother Miqdad, you can continue.
So in terms of being creative, I mean, you can go online and inshallah find a lot of different activities that you can do with your child. Pick out those activities that doesn't require too much preparation, but involves a lot of activity, a lot of sweating and jumping. And sometimes it doesn't take too much. If the parents get involved as well, as a mom, for example, dad gets involved, and if you have siblings, and or if you get involved and play a game together, doing this throughout the day would really help to get the child to freshen up, basically, and feel more happy. Sometimes, for example, I don't know, take a balloon, for example, and play a game of trying to keep the balloon up in the air, right? And you have different obstacles to try and make it more challenging for the child. And you realize that a mom gets involved, siblings get involved, it becomes a very nice atmosphere. And at the same time, becomes very, very active. And this activity is very, very precious, because it will lead to the child not feeling lethargic anymore, not wanting to snack. The behavior will change, basically, slowly, slowly.
True. So they need to stay active, don't need to sit idle.
Exactly, yes. I know it's in today's world, it's very easy to switch on the TV and let the child watch TV throughout the day, but that's very, very dangerous. Not just about the content that they're going to learn, but also at a physical level as well. It's not going to help them in any way to feel better about themselves or to be able to grow intellectually and spiritually. So yes, as much as you can. If you have to stay indoors, then try plan different activities throughout the day. I know sometimes it's an effort, but those kind of challenges that we have to go through, Use the internet. You'll find different activities online to be able to keep the child as much active as possible. So if you have access to a garden, that's ideal as well. And then from time to time, there's other things that you can do outside. So I know the conditions might not allow this all the time, but if there is, I don't know, if you can go outside the city for a ride, yeah. For those cities don't have a lockdown. For instance, climbing a small hill or a mountain, that's probably one of the best exercises out there, is to climb a mountain. Because
so you're basically talking about physical activities.
Physical activity, basically. Physical activities with the family, ideally, to get the child to be on their toes, basically, on their feet, basically, the whole day. And things like mountain climbing is very, very useful, because mountain climbing is not just a physical sport, but it has a lot of impact on different aspects of one personality, because it's a challenge. When you reach the top, you're really tired, you now have to go back down.
True.
It sometimes involves a lot of teamwork, because you have to help one another. If you have siblings, you have to stay on the same pace and make sure you don't go too fast or too slow. You have to plan together.
That's actually cool.
Exactly. Yeah. So it involves a lot of things together, which is quite it's quite refreshing, basically, for children. And
it's also adventurous.
It's adventurous as well, yes. So if you have those kind of rural places that you can go outside of the city, then that's definitely worth it, and I would recommend that. Another thing I'd like to mention over here, since we're talking about this, is the fact that it's important to make sure that, and I know this is difficult in this COVID period, but it's to make a child feel challenged, basically. Sometimes we try and make the grounds for the child in such a way that everything's very smooth and running, and there's no issues or difficulties in a child's life. I don't mean to say that you have to purposely create a difficult situation or purposely annoy the child to mm-hmm. make him feel kind of pain. No, that's not what I mean. I mean that part of life should be that children should face challenges, should face difficulties of life.
Like what?
So when we talk about mountain climbing, for example, it's a difficult challenge, right, at times. And this is a good thing. Or, for example, when you're out in the garden and you want to build something, carrying a heavy stone, let the child carry the heavy piece of wood, for example, that you want to build, let's say, a wood house. Or allow the child to do certain things that might perhaps be slightly, not dangerous, but might slightly make them feel a bit of pain, for example. Uh-huh. That's perfectly fine. For example, using a couple of tools, using a hammer, for example, right? A 6-year-old, 7-year-old should be able to use a hammer. I know at times it's possible that they might hurt themselves, but it's part of life for children to learn the difficulties of life, basically. Yeah. As parents, we need to not cover them in a bubble, overprotect them so much that they don't feel difficulties of life.
Dear listeners, thank you so much for joining with us, and we'll be right back after a short break.
Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, "It is a recommended practice for a child to play in his childhood so that he becomes patient in his adulthood."
Welcome back, the audience of IRIB English Radio. And we're talking what kids can do in the situation of lockdown. How can they keep themselves busy? So we're talking to Brother Meghdad, and I would like him to continue.
So we were talking about the importance of making children feel challenged, children feeling the difficulties of doing things. One of the things that they have over here locally is these trips that they go on. I think we have them in different countries, all scouts, basically. Yeah. When you go out in camping, for instance, or in the forest, for instance, and you're in charge of different difficult tasks, which are part of the journey, basically. Yeah. So whether it's, I don't know, putting up a tent or digging up a place for the toilet or making a fire to cook food. One of the things one of the results of these trips is that children come out much stronger.
Yeah.
Children come out much more able and skilled to do things. As opposed to when we try and overprotect the child so much that they become kind of spoiled and uh-huh. lazy or unable to, don't have the skills basically to face the challenges of the world.
True, so parents should let their children learn new stuff.
Exactly. They should allow the child to learn new stuff, learn new skills, even though if that means that they might feel pain, they might feel get tired, they might
build themselves up.
Exactly. They need to be built themselves up, basically. So that's very important. And especially in these lockdown periods where we're at home, and when you're at home, you're not challenged, you're not facing any sort of difficulty, you're lazing about basically all day. And as parents, we should try as much as we can to not allow that to happen, because on a long term, this will have negative consequences. So it requires us parents to really be creative, really put some effort towards this, to try and get children to not just to exercise, not just to be active, not just to be on their feet and sweating and jumping and running and having their heartbeats go really, really fast, okay, with a lot of fun, with a lot of joy. But at the same time, we need to make sure that these children are challenged, they're facing the difficult tasks that are important tasks to take, they feel important about themselves, that they're being able to achieve things, and they learn skills that are life skills, basically. Yeah. This is something really quite important.
So that was actually a really good explanation. So parents should not just let their children, sit idle at home. They should allow them to learn new stuff. So parents, so just let your children go out and learn new things. So you can take them to a park, you can take them, for mountain climbing, rappelling, grappling, and all. So dear listeners, this was your host, Hassanain, and I'm really thankful to Brother Meghdad for being with us. And dear listeners, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. And visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And until another program, God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Donald Trump has held his first political rally since losing the presidential election, delivering an incoherent speech peppered with baseless conspiracy theories about election fraud and attacks on Republican state officials in Georgia, who have refused to help him subvert the election results. In front of a crowd of thousands of mostly maskless, non-socially distanced supporters in South Georgia, Donald Trump claimed, falsely, that he had won the presidential election and called for those in government with courage and wisdom to help him reverse the election result. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Oliver Lachland. The piece is titled, Trump Rails Against Election Result at Rally Ahead of Crucial Georgia Senate Runoff. Stay with us for more of Oliver Lachland's article. Donald Trump has held his first political rally since losing the presidential election, delivering an incoherent speech peppered with baseless conspiracy theories about election fraud and attacks on Republican state officials in Georgia who have refused to help him subvert the election results. In front of a crowd of thousands of mostly maskless, non-socially distanced supporters in South Georgia, Donald Trump claimed, falsely, that he had won the presidential election and called for those in government with courage and wisdom to help him reverse the election result. The president's rally on a cold evening at a regional airport in the small city of Valdosta, Georgia on Saturday night came ahead of a crucial U.S. Senate runoff election in January, which will decide control of the upper house and ultimately play a decisive role in President-elect Joe Biden's ability to legislate. Donald Trump has ostensibly traveled to Georgia as a show of support for the two Republican Senate candidates for the January poll, Senator Kelly Loeffler and Senator David Perdue, but spent the majority of his speech railing against the results of the presidential election. He began his speech, which lasted more than 90 minutes, by falsely claiming he had won the state of Georgia, which he lost to Joe Biden by over 12,000 votes, in a result that was certified by the Republican Secretary of State in Georgia more than 2 weeks ago. They cheated and they rigged our presidential election, but we will still win, Trump falsely claimed. And they're going to try and rig this Senate election too. The president read from a prepared list of nonsensical evidence that he said highlighted his victory. This included arguing that by winning the states of Ohio and Florida, he had in fact won the entire election, and also that winning an uncontested Republican Party primary earlier this year was proof that he had won against Joe Biden in November. Trump lost the Electoral College vote by 306 votes to 232, and the popular vote by over 7 million votes. His campaign has launched numerous legal challenges in various states. An Associated Press tally showed that of roughly 50 cases brought by Donald Trump's campaign and his allies, more than 30 have been rejected or dropped, and about a dozen are awaiting action. Donald Trump vented fury at the Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, a one-time political ally of the president, who has resisted calls to join Trump's attempts to overturn the result in the state of Georgia. "Your governor could stop it very easily if he knew what the hell he was doing," Trump told the crowd. He added, "For whatever reason, your Secretary of State and your governor are afraid of Stacey Abrams," a reference to the former Democratic gubernatorial candidate who is a staunch voting rights advocate and helped drive the turnout in the election and secure the state for Joe Biden. The rally came just hours after the Washington Post reported that Donald Trump pressured Brian Kemp to overthrow the results of the election in the state during a Saturday morning phone call. Trump pushed Kemp to convene a special session of the state legislature in a bid to send Trump backing presidential electors when the Electoral College convenes on 14th of December. Brian Kemp denied the request from the president, according to the Washington Post. Trump then made a similar demand on Twitter in the afternoon. The president also demanded an audit of absentee ballot signatures in the state, which Brian Kemp, the governor, does not have the power to authorize. At the rally, which was reminiscent of many of his campaign rallies, Donald Trump railed against coronavirus and resulting restrictions and stoked fears of tax changes under a Democratic administration. He also claimed if he thought he had lost the presidential election, he would be a very gracious loser. He said, "I'd go to Florida and I'd take it easy." The President and First Lady Melania Trump appeared at a regional airport in Valdosta in Lowndes County in southern Georgia, a staunchly Republican region, on Saturday night. Trump reminded the chanting crowd that he came to southern Georgia on behalf of the two senators facing runoffs, but he quickly turned to his repeated claims, made without evidence, of widespread fraud in the presidential election. The Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, was strongly backed by Trump in his run for office in 2018, but he did not attend a rally on Saturday. The governor has drawn Trump's ire after certifying a state contest Joe Biden won by more than 12,000 votes. It was reported on Saturday that Trump called Kemp from the White House to ask him to overturn the Georgia result. Brian Kemp reportedly declined. Trump persisted, tweeting that Kemp should immediately ask for a special session of the legislature. As the crowd at the rally chanted, "Stop the steal," Trump said, "Your governor could stop it very easily if he knew what the hell he was doing." According to a tweet from Brian Kemp, Donald Trump also asked him to order an audit of signatures on absentee ballot envelopes in his state, a step Brian Kemp is not empowered to take because he has no authority to interfere in the electoral process on Trump's behalf. Donald Trump has repeatedly tied the Georgia runoffs to his baseless accusations of electoral fraud in key states, claims he insisted on Friday would inspire Republicans in Georgia ahead of the Senate runoffs. "Spirits will soar and everyone will rush out and vote," he wrote. Many analysts, however, think Donald Trump's baseless claims that the election was rigged could actually depress Republican turnout, handing a vital advantage to John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, the Democratic challengers to Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue. If the Democratic challengers Ossoff and Warnock win, the Senate will be split 50-50, and Kamala Harris's vote as vice president will give the Democrats control of the Senate. Polling in both races in Georgia is very tight.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.